Side 13. The Autobiography of Malcolm X. Continuing on page 445. The weather had turned very cold. Icicles hung from the collapsed roof of the fire-ruined building that had housed Black Muslim Mosque No. 7. The Amsterdam News, its offices barely a block down 8th Avenue from the funeral home where Malcolm X's body lay, editorialized, "Steady, Eddie," saying that orderly tributes to Malcolm X would confound his critics, who would like nothing better than to see black people rioting over his remains. The fear of serious mass rioting set off by some unpredictable spark hung steadily in the air. An increasing number of Harlem leaders declared that the principal reason for this was the downtown white press media sensationalizing what was going on in a calm, dignified community. Finally, the Harlem Ministers Interfaith Association would issue a formal accusation. "The screaming headlines of many of our newspapers make it seem as if all of Harlem was an armed camp, ready to explode at any moment. The vast majority of the citizens of the Harlem community is not involved in the unfortunate acts of violence that have been grossly overplayed by the press. Many times the slanting of the news is able to bring about an atmosphere through which a few depraved and reckless individuals can take advantage." Malcolm X died broke. That headline in Harlem's Amsterdam News came as a shock to many in the community. Few had reflected that Malcolm X, upon becoming a black Muslim minister, had signed an oath of poverty, so that for 12 years he never acquired anything in his own name. Somewhere I've read that Malcolm X in his black Muslim days received about $175 weekly to cover his living and other expenses exclusive of travel. He left his four daughters and pregnant wife with no insurance of any kind, no savings, and no income, the Amsterdam News story said. And it might have added that he never drew up a will. He had made a February 26th appointment with his lawyer, 5 days after his death. Within the week, two groups had organized and were asking Harlemites for contributions to help Sister Betty raise and educate the children, since organized as the Malcolm X Daughters Fund at Harlem's Freedom National Bank, 275 West 125th Street. In Boston, Malcolm X's half-sister, Mrs. Ella May Collins, told a news conference that she would choose the leaders of the OAAU to succeed Malcolm X. Mrs. Collins operated the Sarah A. Little School of Preparatory Arts, where, she said, children were taught Arabic, Swahili, French, and Spanish. In 1959, she too had broken away from Elijah Muhammad's black Muslims, to which she had originally been converted by Malcolm X. Far from Harlem, in lands where Malcolm X had traveled, the press had given the murder a coverage that had highly irritated the director of the United States Information Agency, Carl T. Rowan, himself a Negro. In Washington, addressing the American Foreign Service Association, Rowan said that when he first heard of the murder, he knew it would be grossly misconstrued in some countries where people were unaware what Malcolm X represented. And he said the USIA had worked hard to inform the African press of the facts about Malcolm X and his preachments, but still there had been a host of African reaction based on misinformation and misrepresentation. Said USIA Director Rowan, "Mind you, here was a Negro who preached segregation and race hatred, killed by another Negro, presumably from another organization that preaches segregation and race hatred, and neither of them representative of more than a tiny minority of the Negro population of America." Rowan held up some foreign newspapers. "All this about an ex-convict, ex-dope peddler, who became a racial fanatic," continued Rowan. "I can only conclude that we Americans know less about what goes on in the minds of other peoples than we thought, or the need to inform is even greater than we in USIA thought it to be." The Daily Times of Lagos in Nigeria had said, "Like all mortals, Malcolm X was not without his faults, but that he was a dedicated and consistent disciple of the movement for the emancipation of his brethren, no one can doubt. Malcolm X has fought and died for what he believed to be right. He will have a place in the Palace of Martyrs." The Ghanaian Times, Accra, called Malcolm X the militant and most popular of Afro-American anti-segregationist leaders, and it added his name to a host of Africans and Americans, ranging from John Brown to Patrice Lumumba, who were martyred in freedom's cause. Also in Accra, the Daily Graphic, The assassination of Malcolm X will go down in history as the greatest blow the American integrationist movement has suffered since the shocking assassination of Medgar Evers and John F. Kennedy. The Pakistan Hurriyat of Karachi said, "A great Negro leader." The Pakistan Times said, "His death is a definite setback to the Negro movement for emancipation." The Peking China People's Daily said the killing happened because Malcolm X fought for the emancipation of the 23 million American Negroes. According to correspondence reports, the First Algerian headline said, "The Ku Klux Klan assassinated Malcolm X." The pro-communist Alger Republican's editorial on the slaying accused American fascism, and the Times Algerian correspondent said Algerians showed signs of raising Malcolm X to martyrdom. The U.S. consulate in Georgetown, British Guiana, was marched on by pickets accusing American imperialists. Another Peking China paper, Jianmin Jipao, said that the death showed that in dealing with imperialists' oppressors, violence must be met with violence. Pravda in Moscow carried only brief stories and no editorial comment, the New York Times Moscow correspondent said. And another in Poland said there was no noticeable reaction of any kind, and that few Poles had heard of Malcolm or were interested in the racial issue. Reportedly, the murder was only routinely reported with little special interest by the press in Cairo, Beirut, New Delhi, and Saigon. In Paris and Western Europe, the story was essentially a one-day sensation, with the West German press handling it as if it were in the Chicago gangster tradition. The New York Times said, "The London newspapers have probably played the story harder and longer than most, giving continuing emphasis to the police work on the murder." The London Times and the London Daily Telegraph both carried editorial comments, but neither treated Malcolm X as a major figure. Also reported by the New York Times London correspondent was that a London group calling itself the Council of African Organizations has violently attacked the United States over the murder. This group is made up of students and other unofficial African representatives here. A press release described Malcolm as a leader in the struggle against American imperialism, oppression, and racialism. It said, "The butchers of Patrice Lumumba are the very same monsters who have murdered Malcolm X in cold blood." Friday morning, New York City press headlines concerning Malcolm X's slaying were devoted to the police department's apprehension of a second slaying suspect. He was a stocky, round-faced, 26-year-old karate expert named Norman 3X Butler, allegedly a black Muslim, and a week later, this was followed by the arrest of Thomas 15X Johnson, also allegedly a black Muslim. Both men had been early indicted in the January 1965 shooting of Benjamin Brown, a New York City correction officer and a black Muslim defector. Both men were indicted, along with Hayer, for the murder of Malcolm X on March 10th. With the news announcement of Butler's arrest and his at least tentative identification as a member of Elijah Muhammad's organization, tension reached a new high among all who had any role in the feud. The Black Muslim National Convention was scheduled to begin that Friday in Chicago to last for 3 days. Early Friday morning in New York at the Kennedy Airport, dozens of policemen spent 40 minutes searching a plane belonging to Capital Airlines, which back in December 1964 had accepted a Mach No. 7 charter flight to Chicago and return at a fee of $5,175.54, which the mosque had subsequently paid in increments. Altogether, about 3,000 black Muslims from their mosques in most sizable cities were in Chicago for their annual Savior's Day convention, regarded by them as similar to the holiday of Christmas. In the order of arrival, each group from the different mosques and cities assembled outside the big sports coliseum south of Chicago's business district. The brothers of all ages dressed in neat dark suits and white shirts, and the sisters garbed in flowing silk gowns and headdresses. And every individual was filtered through an intense security check that Chicago police sources said was unprecedented in Chicago, except for a visiting president. Searched even more closely were the relatively few non-Muslim Negroes who came to be spectators, and the press representatives, both white and black. "Take off your hat, show some respect," snapped a black Muslim guard at a white reporter. As each person was cleared, a Fruit of Islam man ushered him or her to a specific seat in the drafty interior of the 7,500-seat Coliseum. Later, Muslim sources would blame the half-full house upon the white man's dividing of Negroes. But observers who recall the packed Coliseum in 1964 said that bombing fears kept away many non-Muslim Negroes. The audience sat lightly murmuring under the two huge hanging banners proclaiming, "Welcome, Elijah Muhammad. We are glad to have you with us." And, "We must have some of this land." Referring to Elijah Muhammad's demand that one or more states be turned over to the 23 million so-called Negroes in America as partial reparation for over a century of our free blood and sweat as slaves, which helped to develop this wealthy nation where still today you show us you do not wish or intend to accept us as equals. In front of the wide, raised speaker's platform were two nearly life-sized photographic blow-ups of Elijah Muhammad. Standing between the stage and the audience were Fruit of Islam guards. Others were prowling the aisles, scanning rows of faces, with intermittent peremptory demands for identification. "What mosque, brother?" Still more Fruit of Islam men were inspecting the Coliseum's vacant balcony, backstage, downstairs, and rafters and roof. The ghost of Malcolm X was in the Coliseum. First in a high drama for the Muslims, Elijah Muhammad's son, Wallace Delaney Muhammad, who once had sided with Malcolm X, faced the audience and begged forgiveness for his defection. Next, two brothers of Malcolm X, Wilfred and Filbert, both of them black Muslim ministers, urged unity with Elijah Muhammad. Said Minister Wilfred X of the Detroit Mosque, "We would be ignorant to get confused and go to arguing and fighting among ourselves and forget who the real enemy is." Said Minister Filbert X of the Lansing Mosque, "Malcolm was my own blood brother, next to me." I was shocked. No man wants to see his own brother destroyed. But I knew that he was traveling on a very reckless and dangerous road. I made attempts to change his course. When he was living, I tried to keep him living. Now that he is dead, there is nothing I can do. Indicating the seated Elijah Muhammad, Minister Filbert X declared, "Where he leads me, I will follow." And then he introduced the black Muslim leader to make his address. Only the head of Elijah Muhammad was visible above the grim-faced Fruit of Islam men in a living wall, Cassius Clay among them. Crescents, stars, moons, and suns were in gold thread embroidery on the small fez that Elijah Muhammad wore. He said in his speech, "For a long time, Malcolm stood here where I stand. In those days, Malcolm was safe. Malcolm was loved. God himself protected Malcolm. For more than a year, Malcolm was given his freedom. He went everywhere, Asia, Europe, Africa, even to Mecca, trying to make enemies for me. He came back preaching that we should not hate the enemy. He came here a few weeks ago to blast away his hate and mudslinging, everything he could think of to disgrace me. We didn't want to kill Malcolm and didn't try to kill him. They know I didn't harm Malcolm. They know I loved him. His foolish teaching brought him to his own end." Both physically and emotionally worked up, often Elijah Muhammad would begin coughing. "Take it easy. Take your time," his audience pleaded with him. "He had no right to reject me," Elijah Muhammad declared. "He was a star who went astray. They knew I didn't harm Malcolm, but he tried to make war against me." He said that Malcolm X would have been given the most glorious of burials if he had stayed with the black Muslims and had died a natural death. "Instead, we stand beside the grave of a hypocrite." Malcolm. Who was he leading? Who was he teaching? He has no truth. We didn't want to kill Malcolm. His foolish teaching would bring him to his own end. "I am not going to let the crackpots destroy the good things Allah sent to you and me." Elijah Muhammad drove his frail energy to speak for about an hour and a half. He challenged any would-be assassins. "If you seek to snuff out the life of Elijah Muhammad, you are inviting your own doom. The Holy Quran tells us not to pick a fight, but to defend ourselves. We will fight." It was mid-afternoon when Elijah Muhammad turned back to his seat with some 3,000 black Muslim men, women, and children shouting, "Yes, sir." So sweet. All praise to Muhammad. In the Unity Funeral Home in the Harlem community of New York City in the mid-afternoon, the public's viewing of the body of Malcolm X was interrupted by the arrival of a party of about a dozen people whose central figure was a white-turbaned, dark-robed, elderly man whose white beard fell to his chest and who carried a forked stick. When reporters rushed to attempt interviews, another man in the party waved them away, saying, "A silent tongue does not betray its owner." The man was Sheikh Ahmed Hassoun, a Sudanese, a member of the Sunni Muslims, who had taught in Mecca for 35 years when he had met Malcolm X there, and then had soon come to the United States to serve as Malcolm X's spiritual advisor and to teach at the Muslim Mosque Incorporated. Sheikh Hassoun prepared the body for burial in accordance with Muslim ritual. Removing the Western clothing in which the body had been on display, Sheikh Hassoun washed the body with special holy oil. Then he draped the body in the traditional 7 white linen shrouds, called the kafan. Only the face, with its reddish mustache and goatee, was left exposed. The mourners who had come with Sheikh Hassoun filed to the bier, and he read passages from the Quran. Then he turned to a funeral home representative. "Now the body is ready for burial." Soon the Sheikh and his retinue left, and the viewing by the public resumed. When the word spread, numbers of persons who had come before returned for another wait in the long, slowly moving line, wanting to see the Muslim burial dress. It was late during this Friday afternoon that I got into the quietly moving line, thinking about the Malcolm X with whom I had worked closely for about 2 years. Blue-uniformed policemen stood at intervals watching us shuffle along within the wooden, gray-painted police barricades. Just across the street, several men were looking at the line from behind a large side window of the Lone Star Barbershop, Eddie Johns, proprietor, William Ash, manager. Among the policemen were a few press representatives talking to each other to pass the time. Then we were inside the softly lit, hushed, cool, large chapel. Standing at either end of the long, handsome bronze coffin were two big, dark policemen, mostly looking straight ahead, but moving their lips when some viewer tarried. Within minutes, I'd reached the coffin. Under the glass lid, I glimpsed the delicate white shrouding over the chest and up like a hood about the face on which I tried to concentrate for as long as I could. All that I could think was that it was he, all right. Malcolm X. "Move on." The policeman's voice was soft. "Malcolm looked to me just waxy and dead." The policeman's hand was gesturing at his waist level. I thought, well, goodbye. I moved on. 22,000 people had viewed the body when the line was stopped that night for good at 11 p.m. Quietly, between midnight and dawn, a dozen police cars flanked a hearse that went the 20-odd blocks farther uptown to the Faith Temple. The bronze coffin was wheeled inside and placed upon a platform draped in thick, dark red velvet in front of the altar, and the coffin's lid was reopened. As the hearse pulled away, policemen stood at posts of vigil, both inside and outside Faith Temple. It was crispy cold outside. About 6 a.m., people began forming a line on the east side of Amsterdam Avenue. By 9 a.m., an estimated 6,000 persons thronged the nearby blocks behind police barriers, and faces were in every window of the apartment buildings across the street. Some stood shivering on fire escapes. From 145th Street to 149th Street, policemen had blocked off all automobile traffic except for their own cars, the newspapers' cars, and the equipment trucks for radio and television on-the-spot coverage. There were hundreds of policemen, some on the rooftops in the immediate area. Combing the crowd's edges were reporters with microphones and notebooks. "He was fascinating, a remarkably fascinating man. That's why I'm here," a white girl in her mid-20s told a New York Times man. "And a Negro woman. I'm paying my respects to the greatest black man in this century. He's a black man. Don't say colored." Another woman, noticing steel helmets inside a television network car, laughed to the driver, "You getting ready for next summer?" When the Faith Temple doors were opened at 9:20, a corps of OAAU members entered. Within the next quarter hour, 20 of the men had ushered in 600 seat holders. 50 press reporters, photographers, and television cameramen clustered beneath religious murals to the rear of the altar, and some stood on chairs to see better. A Negro engineer monitored recording equipment between the altar and the coffin, which was guarded by 8 uniformed Negro policemen and 2 uniformed Negro policewomen. One Negro plainclothes policeman sat on either side of heavily veiled Sister Betty in the second row. The raised lid of the coffin hid the Faith Temple's brass tithe box and candelabra. The head of the Islamic Mission of America in Brooklyn, Sheikh Alhaj Dawood Ahmed Faisal, had counseled that any hint of Christianity in the services would make the deceased a kafir, an unbeliever. The Sheikh had also dissented with the days of public exhibition of the body. Death is a private matter between Allah and the deceased. Before the services began, OAAU ushers brought in one floral wreath, a 2x5 arrangement of the Islamic star and crescent in white carnations against a background of red carnations. First, the actor Ossie Davis and his wife, actress Ruby Dee, read the notes, telegrams, and cables of condolence. They came from every major civil rights organization, from individual figures such as Dr. Martin Luther King, from organizations and governments abroad such as the Africa-Pakistan West Indian Society of the London School of Economics, the Pan-African Congress of Southern Africa, the Nigerian ambassador from Lagos, the president of the Republic of Ghana, Dr. Kwame Nkrumah. The death of Malcolm X shall not have been in vain. Next, Omar Osman stood, a representative of the Islam Center of Switzerland and the United States. We knew Brother Malcolm as a blood brother, particularly after his pilgrimage to Mecca last year. The highest thing that a Muslim can aspire to is to die on the battlefield and not die at his bedside. He paused briefly to wait out the applause from among the mourners. Those who die on the battlefield are not dead, but are alive. The applause was louder, and cries rose, "Right! Right!" Omar Osman then critically commented upon the remarks which USIA Director Karl Rowan had made in Washington, D.C. about the foreign press reaction to the death of the deceased. From the audience then, hisses rose. Again, the actor Ossie Davis stood. His deep voice delivered the eulogy to Malcolm X, which was going to cause Davis subsequently to be hailed more than ever among Negroes in Harlem. Here, at this final hour, in this quiet place, Harlem has come to bid farewell to one of its brightest hopes, extinguished now and gone from us forever. Many will ask what Harlem finds to honor in this stormy, controversial, and bold young captain, and we will smile. They will say that he is of hate, a fanatic, a racist, who can only bring evil to the cause for which you struggle. And we will answer and say unto them, did you ever talk to Brother Malcolm? Did you ever touch him or have him smile at you? Did you ever really listen to him? Did he ever do a mean thing? Was he ever himself associated with violence or any public disturbance? For if you did, you would know him. And if you knew him, you would know why we must honor him. Malcolm was our manhood, our living black manhood. This was his meaning to his people. And in honoring him, we honor the best in ourselves. And we will know him then for what he was and is, a prince. Our own black, shining prince, who didn't hesitate to die because he loved us so. Brief speeches were made by others. Then the family, the OAAU members, and other Muslims present stood and filed by the coffin to view the body for the last time. Finally, the two plainclothes policemen ushered Sister Betty to have her last sight of her husband. She leaned over, kissing the glass over him. She broke into tears. Until then, almost no crying had been heard in the services, but now Sister Betty's sobs were taken up by other women. The services had lasted a little over an hour when the 3 minutes of prayers said for every Muslim who is dead were recited by Alhaj Hesham Jaber of Elizabeth, New Jersey. At the phrase, Allahu Akbar, God is most great, all Muslims in the audience placed their opened hands at the sides of their faces. An official cortege with a hearse of 3 family cars, 18 mourners' cars, 12 police cars, and 6 press cars, followed by about 50 other cars, briskly drove the 18 miles out of Manhattan and along the New York Thruway, then off its exit 7 to reach the Ferncliff Cemetery in Ardsley, New York. All along the route, Negroes placed their hats or hands over their hearts, paying their final respects. At each bridge crossing in Manhattan County, police cars stood watch. The Westchester County Police had stationed individual patrolmen at intervals en route to the cemetery. Over the coffin, final Muslim prayers were said by Sheikh Alhaj Hesham Jaber. The coffin was lowered into the grave, the head facing the east, in keeping with Islamic tradition. Among the mourners, the Muslims knelt beside the grave to pray with their foreheads pressed to the earth, in the Eastern manner. When the family left the gravesite, followers of Malcolm X would not let the coffin be covered by the white gravediggers who had stood a little distance away, waiting. Instead, seven OAAU men began dropping bare handfuls of earth down on the coffin. Then they were given shovels, and they carried dirt to fill the grave, and then mound it. The night fell over the earthly remains of El Hajj Malik El Shabazz, who had been called Malcolm X, who had been called Malcolm Little, who had been called Big Red, and Satan, and Homeboy, and other names, who had been buried as a Muslim. According to the Quran, the New York Times reported, the bodies of the dead remain in their graves until the last day, the day of judgment. On this day of cataclysm, the heavens are rent, and the mountains ground to dust, the graves open, and men are called to account by Allah. The blessed, the God-fearing, the humble, the charitable, those who have suffered and been persecuted for Allah's sake, or fought in religious wars for Islam, are summoned to the Garden of Paradise. There, according to the teaching of Muhammad, the Prophet, they live forever by flowing streams, reclining on silken cushions and enjoying the company of dark-eyed maidens and wives of perfect purity. The damned, the covetous, the evildoer, the follower of gods other than Allah, are sent to eternal fire, where they are fed boiling water and molten brass. The death from which ye flee will truly overtake you, the Quran says. Then will ye be sent back to the knower of things secret and open, and he will tell you the truth of the things that ye did. After signing the contract for this book, Malcolm X looked at me hard. A writer is what I want, not an interpreter. I tried to be a dispassionate chronicler, but he was the most electric personality I've ever met, and I still can't quite conceive him dead. It still feels to me as if he's just gone into some next chapter to be written by historians. New York, 1965. Ossie Davis on Malcolm X. Mr. Davis wrote the following in response to a magazine editor's question, "Why did you eulogize Malcolm X?" You're not the only person curious to know why I would eulogize a man like Malcolm X. Many who know and respect me have written letters. Of these letters, I am proudest of those from a sixth grade class of young white boys and girls who asked me to explain. I appreciate you giving me this chance to do so. You may anticipate my defense somewhat by considering the following fact. No Negro has yet asked me that question. My pastor in Grace Baptist Church, where I teach Sunday school, preached a sermon about Malcolm in which he called him a giant in a sick world. Every one of the many letters I got from my own people lauded Malcolm as a man and commended me for having spoken at his funeral. At the same time, and this is important, most of them took special pains to disagree with much or all of what Malcolm said and what he stood for. That is, with one singing exception. They all, every last black, glory-hugging one of them, knew that Malcolm, whatever else he was or was not, Malcolm was a man. White folks do not need anybody to remind them that they are men. We do. This was his one incontrovertible benefit to his people. Protocol and common sense require the Negro stand back and let the white man speak up for us, defend us, and lead us from behind the scene in our fight. This is the essence of Negro politics. But Malcolm said, to hell with that. Get up off your knees and fight your own battles. That's the way to win back your self-respect. That's the way to make the white man respect you. And if he won't let you live like a man, he certainly can't keep you from dying like one. Malcolm, as you can see, was refreshing excitement. He scared hell out of the rest of us, bred as we are to caution, to hypocrisy in the presence of white folks, to the smile that never fades. Malcolm knew that every white man in America profits directly or indirectly from his position vis-a-vis Negroes, profits from racism even though he does not practice it or believe in it. He also knew that every Negro who did not challenge on the spot every instance of racism, overt or covert, committed against him and his people, who chose instead to swallow his spit and go on smiling, was an Uncle Tom and a traitor without balls or guts or any other commonly accepted aspects of manhood. Now, we knew all these things, as well as Malcolm did. But we also knew what happened to people who stick their necks out and say them. And if all the lies we tell ourselves by way of extenuation were put into print, it would constitute one of the great chapters in the history of man's justifiable cowardice in the face of other men. But Malcolm kept snatching our lies away. He kept shouting the painful truth we whites and blacks did not want to hear from all the housetops, and he wouldn't stop for love nor money. You can imagine what a howling, shocking nuisance this man was to both Negroes and whites. Once Malcolm fastened on you, you could not escape. He was one of the most fascinating and charming men I have ever met, and never hesitated to take his attractiveness and beat you to death with it. Yet his irritation, though painful to us, was most salutary. He would make you angry as hell, but he would also make you proud. It was impossible to remain defensive and apologetic about being a Negro in his presence. He wouldn't let you. And you always left his presence with the sneaky suspicion that maybe, after all, you were a man. But in explaining Malcolm, let me take care not to explain him away. He had been a criminal, an addict, a pimp, and a prisoner, a racist, and a hater. He had really believed the white man was a devil. But all this had changed. 2 days before his death, in commenting to Gordon Parks about his past life, he said, "That was a mad scene, the sickness and madness of those days. I'm glad to be free of them." And Malcolm was free. No one who knew him before and after his trip to Mecca could doubt that he'd completely abandoned racism, separatism, and hatred. But he had not abandoned his shock effect statements, his bristling agitation for immediate freedom in this country, not only for blacks, but for everybody. And most of all, in the area of race relations, he still delighted in twisting the white man's tail and in making Uncle Tom's compromises and accommodationists. I deliberately include myself, thoroughly ashamed of the urbane and smiling hypocrisy we practice merely to exist in a world whose values we both envy and despise. But even had Malcolm not changed, he would still have been a relevant figure on the American scene, standing in relation, as he does, to the responsible civil rights leaders, just about where John Brown stood in relation to the responsible abolitionist in the fight against slavery. Almost all disagreed with Brown's mad and fanatical tactics, which led him foolishly to attack a federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry, to lose 2 sons there, and later to be hanged for treason. Yet today the world, and especially the Negro people, proclaim Brown not a traitor, but a hero and a martyr in a noble cause. So in future, I will not be surprised if men come to see that Malcolm X was, within his own limitations and in his own inimitable style, also a martyr in that cause. But there is much controversy still about this most controversial American, and I am content to wait for history to make the final decision. But in personal judgment, there is no appeal from instinct. I knew the man personally, and however much I disagreed with him, I never doubted that Malcolm X, even when he was wrong, was always that rarest thing in the world among us Negroes, a true man. And if, to protect my relations with the many good white folks who make it possible for me to earn a fairly good living in the entertainment industry, I was too chicken, too cautious, to admit that fact when he was alive, I thought, at least, that now, when all the white folks are safe from him at last, I could be honest with myself enough to lift my hat for one final salute to that brave, black, ironic gallantry which was his style and hallmark, that shocking zing of fire and be damned to you, so absolutely absent in every other Negro man I know, which brought him too soon to his death. End of the autobiography of Malcolm X.